Digital 410 proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And joining us tonight, we're throwing it back. We're going back to the way back. We're going back to, like, around episode 87. We're going back to the old days when it was just me, Jeff, with the addition of his new killer mustache. I've only seen that mustache on you one time, friend. I think you're doing, like, your impression of, I just went completely blank. The old movie star, what the hell? Help me out here. I went completely blank.
Are you thinking Billy Zane?
No, like, actually, 1930s, 1940s.
Clark Gable?
Clark Gable, yeah. You're pulling your Clark Gable mustache. I can't believe I completely just floundered on that one, but that's what happens when I'm multitasking. How are you, friend? It's been a while.
It has been a while, I'm sorry about that. I'm excited about tonight, though. It sucks that we're not going to have Henry here, but I think, like you said, we can go back to the old days, and I think we can take care of business.
You know, if things start going like this, there's going to be rumors spreading around. I think Jeff and Henry are the same person. They're never on the show at the same time.
One guy smiles, one guy doesn't.
Yeah, why don't you start smiling more? Henry smiles all the damn time, just blinds you with his teeth. You just can't say, okay, and we get it, Henry, enough. You have great dental work. So I guess I should ask you off this air. You have a kind of exciting announcement. Are we ready to go public with that?
On?
I can't ask you if you're not ready to go public with it. We're live. The family thing.
The family thing.
The thing you texted me about the other day, and I said, ask you how other people think about it. You said mixed emotions, but yada, yada, yada. Okay.
I'm drawing a blank.
Huh?
I'm drawing a blank. Go public with it.
No worries. We'll move forward. So Henry will be back next week. He has some work-related stuff he has to do tonight, which we all get. You know, the hard part about doing this show on a weeknight is trying to get it all lined up where everybody's work can, you know, kind of conjoins and everything works out. But we got an interesting show for you tonight. We're going to get into some topics. You know, we often do the What You're Reading segment, but we're going to go a little deeper in that tonight. But before we do, as we often do, because sometimes this train just keeps on running off the tracks like no brakes are intact. So before we get on down the road, let's go ahead and get the mail call out of the way. Hopefully Jeff is ready with his newly refurbished laptop.
Right. Okay, so this week's mail call reads like this. We'll try to make this quick. Henry, I too have read Ian Toll's trilogy, and it's such an amazing set. One of the things you both touched on was the carrier group's step to the kamikaze threat. The use of destroyers as picket ships, equipped with radar to receive the threat before it could reach the heart of the fleet, had to be no easy task for sailors, as they were basically bait for the kamikazes. Ian touches in his book on how so many of these kamikazes would just swarm and target these picket ships, thinking they were more than what they really were. One of these such ships is now a museum ship here in Charleston, South Carolina. The USS Laffey, DD-724, nicknamed the ship that would not die. She participated in both the Normandy invasion and the invasion of Okinawa, where she earned her name. While serving picket duty on April 16, 1945, Laffey survived despite being badly damaged by four bombs, six kamikaze crashes, and strafing fire that killed 32 and wounded 71. Assistant Communications Officer Lieutenant Frank Manson asked Captain Becton if he thought they'd have to abandon ship, to which he snapped, "No, I'll never abandon ship as long as I have a single gun will fire." Becton did not hear a nearby lookout softly say, "And if I can find one man to fire it." It's a wonderful ship to tour. Also with her is CV-10, the Yorktown, whose air groups assisted in the sinking of the Yamato. If you ever make it this way, please check them out. Now, lastly, if you need a recommendation for your next read, check out Days of Steel Rain, the epic story of a World War II vengeance ship in the year of the kamikaze by Brent E. Jones. It follows one ship from its keel being laid to being crewed, trained, and eventually being in the thick of the kamikaze attacks in the Pacific. Was a great read and one that follows one ship, which is unique. As always, keep up the great show, DJ. To which Henry replied, great email. I actually have a signed copy of Steel Ring, and Brent sent it to me last year. So many thanks to DJ for this email. Henry's one step ahead.
As he always says, hopefully your internet holds up with us. It's getting a little rainy and cloudy out there in Texas way. It's going pretty little, solid, but you're speckling there a little bit. Real quick before we get to the books, I think on the last three or four episodes we've brought up the fact, the question, the puzzle really of how much can we expect battlefields from 1942, 43, 44, 45, 39. How long can we, as historians and World War II aficionados, expect modern-day folk to deal with it, not produce on it, not to have progress in their areas? Because, you know, as we Henry and I talked, and I think, Jeff, you're part of the show, in the Pacific, for example, and a lot of those small islands and atolls, that's asking a lot. Hey, don't do anything with that. You know, that big field over there that you could possibly build on, do this and that, because it's a battlefield that we have, you know, we'd love to go down there and check out. But then you have over in Europe, we're not quite so condensed, but it's still an issue. And if anybody's ever lived all, I don't know, down next to a school where, you know, you have to deal with parent pickup lines, or maybe you live next to a park that it's busy, or a golf course or whatever. Oftentimes, we get annoyed by large groups of people always showing up. We're all familiar with the island as depicted on Band of Brothers, and we're all familiar with European battleground tours. You know the famous photo of Major Dick Winters standing in front of the arches? Familiar with that one?
Oh,
This
yeah.
is from the English version of a Paris website entitled "The Difficult Reconciliation of the Memory of the World War II with Mass Tourism in the Netherlands." Residents of the estate portrayed in the TV series Band of Brothers, produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, will install a fence and charge for photos and tourists in order to stem the flow of tourists around their homes. They have the famous picture above, side by side with the Band of Brothers recreation of that. In uniform, with his helmet resting on his side and a slight smile on his face. This shows U.S. Major Dick Winters posted in 1944 under the archways at the entrance of the estate in East Netherlands. The complex is called, I'm going to destroy this, and I apologize to my Netherlands listeners, Schluwendorf. And it is located in the village of Elist in the Allies troops called the area the island, and the fighting there lasted 198 days during World War II. Winters and his men, members of the Easy Company, transcended the realm of military memory thanks to the television series released in 2001, Band of Brothers, co-produced, as we said before, by filmmaker Steven Spielberg and actor Tom Hanks. The British actor Damian Lewis played Winters, and the image of him posing in the same place as the U.S. officer has become so famous over time that the owners of the property are going to install a fence and charge for photos to stem the flow of tourism. The archway leading to the area is still in place, but both sides are within the grounds. They are private homes and with families whose daily lives are interrupted by crowds of curious onlookers in the search of vestiges of the past. Those who come here tend to come from other war museums, and many are fans of the series who tour all over the war sites mentioned in the show, from Normandy to the Bavarian Alps. Not all of them come from the United States, however. Some come from Brazil, South Africa, Italy, and many other countries. They come to see the room where Winters slept, in which he wrote his reports on the war. The residents of the area, however, want to strike a balance between preserving the past and their privacy. In an email, they explained their decision to adapt some restrictions. Quote, "We are aware of the history in the site, and visitors are permitted, but in order to make the complex accessible and to pay for its maintenance, certain agreements will have to be reached. Visits and photos will have to be paid in the near future. Tickets can be purchased on their website for an extra fee. Visitors will be able to take photos with the original Jeep Willie MB vehicle from the period and a life-size image of Dick Winters. The owners of the estate will be the only ones to charge for the pictures," confirmed the city. And so, you know, that's kind of a tough thing. You know, they understand that this is historic. They understand that it's famous, but they also understand that they want to get up on a Saturday and not have 38 people standing out in front of their house talking loudly and being excited to be there. I can kind of understand it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, when you were reading that, it was making me think about the efforts from like Teddy Roosevelt building our National Park Service, you know, kind of that you have this, you know, a fact that comes your way that you're now cognizant of that there is an issue. And if we don't, you know, step in and create a plan, that issue is just going to get worse and things are just going to get trampled. And I don't know if a program like that even exists that protects places like this. I mean, I know we protect national monuments and I guess like certain battlefields, right? You're not going to have, there's not going to be a shopping center in the middle of Gettysburg. Yeah. That's not going to happen. But just a place like that in the Netherlands, that's maybe not like this national battlefield, but just this this thing from pop culture and the movie genre that now it's become so famous because of one incredible miniseries. Man, that's an outstanding question. I don't know. How do you curb that? I don't know.
Well, let's put it in perspective. Let's say you have a nice swath of land out in Texas. You know, it's pretty decent. You got a little more yard to mow than I do. I can, you know, lay flat and, you know, probably hit my neighbor's house with a ball bat. But let's just say that your house was built in all, I don't know, 1830s. And at some point, some famous Texas Ranger lived in your house. And let's say there was a famous photo of him out at the end of your driveway or something, or, you know, out by your, you know, at the end of your front stoop. And every other day you and your kids wake up to go about your daily lives and there's 38 to 50 people standing on your front yard taking pictures. What do you do? It's one thing if it's like you're saying a national park out in the middle of an open field, but when it's literally outside your bedroom window, perfect example, the famous house in, I think, what is it, San Francisco from the Goonies. The previous owners who had it got tired of all the Goonies fans showing up, wanting to take pictures of the house, waking them up every morning, that they put up signs and they finally sold it. And the new owner's like, hey, come on in. I'm a Goonies fan too. But I don't know. I think after a while, you're just like, can I please just sleep in on a Saturday just once? You know, the thing that got a little weird as I was reading a story, I get the fence and the photos, but, and the Jeep even, but when you're pulling out the cardboard cutout, that's when I'm starting to scratch my head and say, okay, wait a minute. Got me with the Jeep. I understand the fence, but go ahead and put the cardboard cutout back in your kids' room. We don't need that. Now it's starting to turn into a little bit of a, you know, a real tourist trap. It was something you'd see on Route 66 back in the day. Oh, here's Dorothy's house. Come get a picture with this cardboard cutout of Toto. Like, no, I'm good. Right. You can take the cardboard back inside.
It actually, you know, it makes me think of a story from somebody I met that she lived in Killeen, the house behind where Elvis lived when he was stationed there.
Oh, boy.
Their backyards touched, right? They had a fence between them. And, of course, Elvis, you know, because it was like that everywhere, wherever he went, you know, he couldn't go in his front door when he got done with duty, you know, at the end of the day. So she was a little girl at the time, but she said just, you know, every day like clockwork, she said she'd be sitting on the ground watching TV. Elvis comes through the front door, runs right in front of her, says hi real quick through the living room. Mom's in the kitchen, you know.
He stops, grabs a peanut butter banana sandwich.
Right. You know, out the back porch door, goes through the backyard, hops his fence, and sneaks into his backyard. Every day, that was his life. And, yeah, I mean, that's what happens when you reach a lot of people, and people want a piece of this stuff. And I think that's why living history is so important. I think that's why these reenactments are so important, because it's just another vehicle, you know, besides books, besides movies, but just another way to keep the memory alive. And you just gotta trust the masses, I guess, that they're not just gonna destroy this stuff.
Yeah, but what if they step on your wife's rhododendrons every day? It's like, come on, stay off the flowers.
Yeah, to her.
You know, Elvis being the type of guy he was with the reputation he had, I wouldn't be surprised at some point he paid for their mortgage. Just, you know, I'm walking through your house every day. This place is worth $5,500. I'll take care of it, right. You know, adjusting for inflation. We're going to really do some books here, but I saw a storyline coming across my newsfeed today after Jeff suggested we talk about books. Are you familiar with the book called All the Light We Can See?
No.
Well, apparently, they're turning it into a miniseries, and YouTube just recently released another trailer. Netflix has released the latest teaser trailer of All the Light We Can See, a World War II set limited series based on the 2014 Pulitzer Prize winning novel, showing off the chemistry, drama, and battles that helped make the sources so popular. This goes on to say, but yeah, I'm excited. Apparently there's a new straight to Netflix World War II series coming out, and it looks like it may be just based off of the thumbnail and the trailer. I didn't get a chance to watch it, but it looks like it might be more the interesting side that we kind of see with Generation War. Did you ever see that, even though it was all in German?
No.
If you guys haven't seen it, go check out Generation War. It's the story of World War II through the eyes of five German friends who grew up, obviously, in Germany, and has the war impacted them pre-war, during the war, and post-war. You know, obviously, the young men got inscripted into the military. They had to go fight. It wasn't a choice. It's not like they were Nazi youth running around. But you can kind of see one of the boys, you know, he really is resistant to it. He kind of takes on the, hey, I'm here, I got to do what I have to do, but I don't buy into this. And then one of the other one kind of buys into the, you know, the fanaticism of it. And then you see how it affects the women and the home front. And it's a really, it has often been quoted as being the German equivalent of Band of Brothers. It's an interesting, like, 12-part miniseries. It is in German, so you got to turn your subtitles on, unless you like voiceovers. I don't like voiceovers. I'd rather read the subtitles. But if you haven't seen Generation War, check it out. It's very interesting to see how to get the view of the war and the impact from the German civilian thus being drafted into the war, getting their aspect of it and seeing how it affect them. And one of the friends is a well-known actress, and kind of show how she's kind of getting sucked into the propaganda machine, how they're starting to try to use her for, you know, spreading their nonsense. But yeah, it looks like this series is going to be kind of interesting, and it's going to be looked from the German side of things. Yep. The new series is called All the Light We Can See. So that's something we can check out. But without any further ado, let me ask you, do you want to get in the books first or show and tell?
Let's do books first.
Okay, let's go books. It was your idea, so we both got three books. Wow, I saw your post on Facebook. Look like you got about nine, but go ahead and pick book number one. You can do book one, and then I'll do one, and then we'll go back and forth, and we'll call it as we see it if things start to run a little long. Shout out to Jeff Gibson and Jay Rock are both hanging out on YouTube, and we appreciate their comments, and yes, looks like Jay Rocker said he's heard of it. I think he's referring to the book or the miniseries, but yeah, JT Rocker said he's heard of it. But yeah, just shout out to you guys hanging out with us. There's more people watching, but only a few people talking. But on to book number one with Jeff Copsetta.
All right, yeah, book number one. So like we said before we went on, we wanted to talk a few books that we maybe not haven't talked about a whole lot. And I chose five or six, maybe, to me, what I thought were really good war memoirs. Besides, of course, we talk with the old breed on here, right? Harry Crosby's, you know, A Wing and a Prayer. Some of those really like the biggest hard hitters. I wanted to choose some of the other ones, and I think half of them I actually met the author. So that always kind of makes it more of a personal, you know, connection for me. So the first one I wanted to mention was The Man Who Flew the Memphis Belle. This is Bob Morgan's memoir, and what it was like. Just, you know, you guys know me, right? I can't get enough Memphis Belle, but I'll be honest, this one, he's just as good a writer as I think he was a pilot. And it's just kind of an intimate look on how he grew up. The guy, so, you know, from Asheville, North Carolina, but partied at like the Vanderbilt's house. So like came up with slightly privileged, had a little bit of money. Apparently the Morgans did. I guess that furniture business did pretty well and had some pretty affluent friends. So just seeing that kind of lifestyle, you really learn how it bled into. I mean, this guy was going to be famous. Like, you just reading the story before he's flying the bell. Like, this guy just has that thing, you know, and it just kind of, to me, it really spawned from the way he grew up. You learn a lot about how these guys trained. A unique factor that, you know, that we used here in America, where we didn't take military trained pilots for their first flight with the cadets. We were actually contracting civilians with pilot's licenses, you know, crop duster type guys, old barnstormers, things like that. Because if this cadet crashes this aircraft, you technically don't lose
two assets
now. Or military aircraft. You lose a civilian and you lose a cadet, which is still in essence still a civilian until they get their pilot's license. As a cadet, you're not technically in the Air Corps yet. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. So when you
we never really thought about it, but it makes perfect sense. A civilian knows a civilian pilot, Pan Am pilot, whatever. They a lot of those became captains, but in your situation, you're talking about making them a training pilot. Yes, they know how to fly. But if you were to take a regular pilot, you know, a Air Corps pilot who actually has the experience, and as you said, they crash, you're losing a very expensive asset who's already gone through training, who maybe perhaps has some experience under their wing, no pun intended. So it would make perfect sense that obviously you don't want to lose either one of them, but if you had to choose, you want to lose the one who knows how to fly or the one who knows how to fly plus fight.
Exactly. So I thought that was an interesting aspect. And it's just his you learn a lot about the crew, the intimacy with his crew, especially his relationship with his tail gunner, Johnny Quinlan. Johnny's one of the few that actually made all 25 missions with Robert Morgan. You know, it's not these same 10 guys made all 25 missions, right? You learn all that, right? There's no, and I think I mentioned this before, like there's really no superlative that we think of about the Memphis Belle. That's actually true. It's like not the first plane to fly 25 missions, not the first crew. He's not even the first pilot in the 8th Air Force to fly 25 missions. Ironically, it was his co-pilot, and he was only his co-pilot for the first few missions. And then Captain Varinus got his own plane, and in the 90s, records finally showed that he flew 25 missions before Bob Morgan and comes home totally in the shadow of Morgan and his crew, but who cares, right?
Yeah, I guess so that part would depend on the ego of the person that it's happening to. If it's somebody who wants to just go about their life in privacy, then they wouldn't care. But if you are much like half the people living in 2023, you'd be upset they're not mentioning it in the papers.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't, you know, people, things were different back then. And another facet I thought was interesting was just kind of that oxymoron of military intelligence and why they do what they do. You know, when the crew came home and they were done with the bond tour, you know, Morgan goes back and he sees a shiny new B-29 and flies another 25 missions over in the Pacific. In fact, he led the first firebombing raid on Tokyo in November 44 in his B-29 Dauntless Dottie. Well, he wanted his tail gunner. He wanted Johnny Quinlan. And the military told him, you know, sure, absolutely. They pulled Quinlan and they put him in a B-29 squadron, not Bob Morgan's squadron, not in his airplane. And that B-29 was shot down.
Now, was the B-29 the basically looked like it was made out of stainless steel? Is that the shiny one?
Yeah.
That they used to drop the atomic bombs?
Right, right.
Okay. As you guys know, I'm not like up to speed on all my aircraft nomenclature. I actually have a photo of one hanging up here in a studio that I got a couple years back for Christmas. That's why I kept looking at my shoulder like, I think it's that one. But I really need to get up on the nomenclature of my air vehicles.
That's anyway, aircraft. So that's book number one.
Interestingly enough, my book number one is aeronautical as well. This book was a Christmas gift to me called The Last Fighter Pilot. It was autographed by the author. However, it was intended to be autographed by the source material, Mr. Captain Jerry Yellen. But sadly, during the time of this purchase, and it did come with a certificate, Mr. Yellen was in the hospital under the weather. And so far tonight, I've been reading quite well. So if you guys don't mind, I want to give you a brief little page out of here. And this is why. So this is called The Last Fighter Pilot because these guys were fighting in the Pacific. They were sent up on their last mission. and the rest will be kind of revealed here momentarily. Fortunately for the rest of the world, the coup did not succeed. A group of senior Japanese officers talked to the insurgents off the ledge, convincing them that there was nowhere to go. But while the revolt ended, the war did not. And so, with the shoreline of the enemy territory coming into view, Phil was on his wing. Jerry knew it was time to go back to work. On Jerry's order, all the planes in the squadron dropped their external fuel tanks over the ocean, then started their familiar aerial trek over the great snow-capped peaks of Mount Fuji. As of yet, there has been no radio signal with the word Utah, which is a secret code for the mission's been scrubbed. As the Americans approached the Japanese capital, they began to identify targets. Within minutes, they swooped down over the airfields and attacked despite heavy ground fire. Tracer bullets flew up from the Japanese guns as the 78th made multiple passes over the targets. Phil stayed right tight on Jerry's wing as instructed. Little precursor to this. Before this mission, Phil had one of those visions, one of the sights we often hear about where, oh, hey, I'm not coming back from this mission. This is it for me. So we hear this often. And so Jerry said, hey, you're my wingman. Stay right on my ass. I will get you through this. After strafing the last airfield, Jerry checked his fuel gauge and saw that he was still in good shape. But when one of the pilots radioed that his tank had reached the 90-gallon mark, the Mustang needs for the returning flight, it was time to pull up and begin plotting a course back to Iwo Jima. Jerry looked over at Phil, who was still on his wing, and gave him the thumbs up. Phil looked back and returned the gesture. Confidence. Maybe it was working. With the battle over Tokyo complete, Jerry set his course back out to the ocean and banked to the south. The three other Mustangs and Jerry's flight turned with him. A few minutes later, they approached the coast where they would be rendezvousing with the navigational B-29s. They neared a cloud cover in front of them. Often the case when approaching the astrospheric temperature and inversion near the coast, with Phil still right on his wing, Jerry led the four Mustangs into the cloud bank. Flying at altitude about 7,000 feet, Jerry focused his eyes on the navigational instrument as the interior of the white puffy clouds blocking his view and everything else. But when the Mustang emerged out of the other side of the clouds, the devastation reality soon surfaced. Phil was gone. Most likely he had been brought down by anti-aircraft bullets fired into the clouds. There was no sign of him. His premonition had come to pass. Jerry was devastated. When he had landed at Iwo Jima, meanwhile, he learned something else. The war was over. The Emperor had announced Japan's surrender 3 hours earlier, while Jerry and his flight crew were still over Japan. The code word Utah had been broadcast to U.S. aircraft over the country, but the word had not reached the planes of the 78th until they had landed. It was a surreal feeling for Jerry as he climbed out of the plane and jumped down onto the aircraft. Standing on a once bloody Pacific island, now suddenly the world was at peace. First Lieutenant Phil Schlumenberg, at the age of 19, was the final known combat death of World War II. And to this day, at least as the writing of this book, he had the highest IQ of any pilot in the Air Force. Now this part will blow your mind. Let me find it real quick. I have it marked here. I just got to find it in the book. Sorry.
When was the book written?
This book was written in, I want to say, this is back when I worked at the radio station. So about 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, fairly recent.
Yeah, fairly recent. Hold on. There's a really... This part will just blow your mind. Oh, crap. Oh, here we go. Jerry stood too for Phil Schlumberg, whose death marked the end of the costliest war in human history. Phil's memory would be carried on not only by his fellow pilots, but by his niece, Melanie Salone, who researched his legacy long after his death and by his two great nieces, Vanessa and Scarlett Johansson. Yes, that Scarlett Johansson. That was her great uncle, was the last person to die during World War II, and to this day has the highest IQ rating, at least as per writing of that book, of any pilot in the United States Air Force.
Wow.
That is a tremendous book, especially if you're into aviation. Check it out. And it's Pacific based too. It's called The Last Fighter Pilot. It's written by Don Brown and Captain Jerry Yellen. I'll just give you, actually, there's a fantastic photo of Captain Yellen on the back. And so that is book reference number one for you all to check out if you haven't. And that's kind of something else Jeff and I are trying to do. We're trying to put out some books out there that you may have not heard of. So please check out The Last Fighter Pilot. Jeff, your turn, sir.
Yeah. This one actually stays with the aviation theme, also in the Pacific. But again, another war memoir, one that I really, really enjoyed. Just a great read. Again, another tremendous pilot that became a tremendous writer. And this is called The Jolly Rogers, the story of Tom Blackburn and Navy Fighting Squadron VF-17, otherwise known as Blackburn's Irregulars. Tommy Blackburn was the squadron commander. And not only is this really a really deep insight into the combat in the Pacific in those earlier days down in the Solomons, and some of that just absolute, you can just feel the boredom, just the mundane daily tasks. And then all of a sudden it's highlighted by 15 minutes of terror, right? I mean, that's just kind of, that's kind of the theme behind any combat memoir, right? They give you the nitty gritty of, you know, tossing rocks and just whittling away your time, and then all of a sudden it all breaks loose. So not only that, and that gritty, you know, air to air combat mission, but Tommy Blackburn was an incredible leader. I really feel like anybody that's in a leadership position or is vying for a leadership position, not just in the military, but civilian life as well. You know, if you're facing a promotion at work, you're going to have a few people under your command. Read Tommy Blackburn's stuff, because he's an unbelievable combat leader. He's an unbelievable just somebody that I really look up to, because he was definitely one of the what's the best way to put this? He was a man's man, right? He didn't see himself as, I'm the commander and this is how it is because I'm the guy in charge. He was definitely on the level of his, you know, the guys that followed him in combat. And, you know, crazy things happen. And he even, you know, talks about he's chasing a Zero into a cloud bank, and his wingman, who was actually the XO of the squadron, sees this happen. So the XO kind of comes around in position to get a beat on the Zero, and the Zero comes out of the cloud bank. The XO fires the guns. Tommy Blackburn runs right into the path of the bullets and takes some damage right underneath the cockpit in his Corsair from his own XO. And even how he handles that is a great lesson. So read it.
You know, that kind of reminds me, and I think we've talked about this before, but naval battles, when you have the air cover, you got dogfights going on, you got salvos flying back and forth from each Navy ship, and you're in a dogfight, the enemy planes come down low, they might be trying to strafe a ship or drop a bomb or even maybe a torpedo, and you're falling right on his tail. That enemy's flying into our fire, but you're right behind him. You're like, okay, not only are you worried about someone on your tail, but you're basically flying through your friendly fire trying to take this guy out, because at that point it's just guns all over the place. I think last week Henry and I were talking about, I actually did a barrel count on the Navy vessels, and you know, the amount of firepower coming from each vessel, and that's just a lot of them had like a, you know, anywhere between 50 to 150 different barrels, and that's just a lot of lead being thrown around, and you're flying down there right too, you're right in it as well. And obviously there's no way to tell, but I can guarantee you when a lot of those planes landed and they're counting bullet holes, I'm sure quite a few of them came from our gear too, and in some of those close-knit battles.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, that's probably the two things, and we've discussed this before, where especially a Navy pilot and the men on the ship, that's the one thing they had in common, is both of their battle stations, especially if you're on a submarine, very limited exit strategies, let's just say, and both of them, especially if you're fighting the Pacific, you're going to end up in the ocean if you're lucky to survive, and then that's a whole nother battle right there. And there's maybe one day we need to do an episode on the guys who got shot down and the turmoil of surviving that, but then finding yourself on a raft and where do I go from here? Because that in and of itself is craziness. Book number two for me, we're going to stay with the theme. We did not discuss books or themes. I've mentioned this one in the past. We actually had the author on, and when we post this episode, I'll post a link to the episode where we had Mr. Gregory A. Freeman on the show. And this is Forgotten 500. It's air-themed, but it takes place on the ground, and I'll give you the synopsis off the back. This is the untold story of the men who risked all for the greatest rescue mission of World War II. And this is a different, interesting book, too, because it takes place in a theater that we don't think much about during World War II. During the bombing campaign over the Romanian oil fields, hundreds of American airmen were shot down in Nazi-occupied Yugoslavia. Local Serbian farmers and peasants risked their own lives to give refuge to the soldiers who awaited rescue. In 1944, Operation Halyard was born. Halyard was born. The risks were incredible. The starving American in Yugoslavia had to construct a landing strip large enough for C-47 cargo planes without tools, without alerting the Germans, and without endangering the villagers. And the cargo planes had to make it through enemy airspace and back without getting shot down themselves. Suppressed for more than half a century, due to political reasons, the full account of the unforgettable story of loyalty, self-sacrifice, and bravery is now being told for the first time ever. The Forgotten 500 is a gripping behind-the-scenes look at the greatest escape in World War II. And you say, politics? What's the political aspect? What you'll learn reading this book is in Romania, particularly Yugoslavia at the time, there's a civil war going on versus the communists. And the people of Yugoslavia who didn't want to live under communist rule. And what you also learn in this book is when the forming of the OSS, I believe it's the OSS, I need to get that right before I say this. State Department, yada yada. Yeah, the OSS. When they were forming the OSS and they were looking for operators and people to fulfill, plan, and man these missions and operate the OSS, your political views weren't taken into account. Obviously, if you were a vocal Nazi, that'd be one thing, but anything else. And so there was a lot of communists working in the OSS. And as you can imagine, if you have a political ground war, civil war going on, and you have a communist group trying to take over Yugoslavia, and the people trying to fight for the freedom, people at the OSS who are pro-communist might not be too hip to allow a rescue that's trying to be organized where the people who are doing most of the rescuing are pro-freedom, and some of them are pro-communist, but at the end of the day, if you're pro-communist, you wouldn't want all the glory to go to the pro-freedom people. And so there was a lot of effort to get this operation off the ground all while the Civil War was going on. And as you heard, they had to build a landing strip with really no tools other than shovels, and you know, they had to cut down some trees, remove the rocks, till land, and not be noticed by the Germans. And oh, by the way, very little food up there. And the poor Yugoslavian peasants basically would give up a portion of their family's rations to feed these airmen. And as you can tell by the title, near the end, before the rescue, there was 500 of them in this area. That's a lot of mouths to feed, especially when you're up in the mountains with very little farmland in the middle of a civil war. It's a very, very good book. You'll learn a lot about that area going on in Romania and Yugoslavia at the time. And you'll learn a lot about the OSS and the tremendous story. You know what it reminds me of in a modern day? The Lone Survivor. Did you ever see that? Read that book, the Marcus Luttrell story?
Oh yeah.
Very reminiscent of that. You know, he's out there doing a mission. He's the only one left. The people in town risk their lives hiding him, moving him from place to place, feeding them, bringing them back to health. Very reminiscent of that. The people in these villages finding these airmen as they parachute down. The Germans are looking for them. They see the parachute. They know they shot the planes down. They saw it come down. And much like Lone Survivor, they're hiding them. But after months, there's 500 of them. And so it's a real sticky wicket, you can say. But the whole planning, sending in OSS guys to formulate, plan, sneak out, go back, relay information, come up with the planning, coming up with the logistics, kind of lying about what you're doing with these planes because you got the pro-communists not wanting this mission to happen. It's a tremendous story. So I strongly suggest it. And as I said, when you're listening to this episode on the apps, whether it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts, Google, what have you, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the links for today's episode, and in that page we will go back. Probably this is, we're talking maybe episode 24, 25. Gregory was one of the early authors on the show, and you know that's not nothing. You know, when you first launch a podcast and you're trying to book guests, when you have a show that no one's heard of and you've had guests that no one knows other than some living history folk, to say, hey, I'll come on your show and give your interview style a go. You know, shout out to Gregory for giving me a go back when no one knew who I was, what we were, and it was just me and a dream. So shout out to him. And real quick, before we get on to the next one, let's get the plugs in. While you're heading over to WTSPWorldWar2.com to click on that link to listen to the Gregory Freeman episode about the Forgotten 500, please click on the Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. We have three plans. One's $1 a month. There's two other ones in there. I want to go over those. We're more than happy than $1 a month plan. We have started, and sadly, Jeff just happens to miss the episode when we do the giveaways. We did the last giveaway for the Warbird Coffee last week, even though it technically was supposed to happen at the end of last month, but with the way the holidays laid in. But anyhow, we're going to continue to do giveaways, and so please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the Back the Attack, and I'll take you to Patreon. You can subscribe. That goes a long way to help what we do. Now, Jeff, if you don't mind moving that microphone out of the way, sit up straight and poke your chest out there so everybody can see the fantastic display. That is the new Good Scuttlebutt is Meant to Be Shared shirt. That is now available on our website at WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click the merch link. Got the old school original. Can't really see it. It's the original WTSP shirt with the Marine Corps helmet. All of our shirts. This shirt's 5 years old. All the shirts that we've ever had up there is still there. Head over there. Use the promo code ILISTEN. That'll save you, basically, save you a couple bucks. And you can support the show. Nice thing about Jeff's shirt, it is two-sided. So not only do you have the new logo on the front, but on the back,